Microphone test, ambassador room, mic check 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Anybody that asks questions got to go into this or just repeat the question? You're a pro, I can tell.
Well, I don't know about that.
And don't forget to turn your mic off.
I already did. Well, good afternoon. My name is Sherry Noviello. I'm the director of the School of Nursing at Columbus State University in Columbus, Georgia. And we've been to restaurants and talked to several people, and for some reason they can detect my Georgia accent. I don't think that I have one, but oh well. And thank you for coming to our presentation today. Very exciting. Amy Vail, who is the second presenter, actually was a faculty member in our School of Nursing several years ago. And so when I finished my PhD, my dissertation, she actually took some of my results and ended up doing her DNP project from that. And I also served on her committee. So it was a nice collaborative process. And I think it really supports the theme of this conference. And I told someone when I got off the shuttle at the hotel, we introduced, and she said, "Are you coming to the conference?" And I said, "Yes, I'm probably the only non-nurse practitioner at this conference, or DNP at that." So I'm kind of feel a little strange, but it's good. Get a different environment set up. I just want to give you a little background on my dissertation, so it'll kind of set the screen, the stage for Amy's presentation, which is really the meat of what you came to hear about. The background of my topic interest, I have been an educator for about 23 and a half years, and several of those years I did as, I'm not an OB person, but I did OB clinicals, and would find myself, you know, talking to different people with the newborns, or even I did pediatrics as well, and would hear different stories from family members about their family member being admitted to the hospital and not getting appropriate pain management. Even though they were adults, they, you know, would lay in pain for quite some time and never really could understand why anyone, specifically nurses, would allow that to happen. And then as I went through some of my clinical experiences with my students, I would take them to watch circumcisions, and of course, you know, the OB docs are in there doing the circumcisions, and this one particular doctor, well, there were several that didn't use any kind of anesthetic or anything during his circumcisions, and one time I just couldn't help it, and I said, "Please tell me why you don't use any kind of anesthetic," and he looked at me very strangely and said, "I don't remember my circumcision, and he won't remember his." And I was just appalled by that, and I kept questioning him to the point, I mean, I wasn't ugly, I'm very professional, and but he said, "If you would like for me to throw you out of this room and your students, then you can continue asking your questions, otherwise, please hold your questions." So I really didn't understand that. I'm also an ER nurse, had been for several years, would have experiences where we would have adults come in with orthopedic injuries, and they would be given major, you know, drugs while they were there, and then they would be given some kind of narcotic to go home for pain management. We would get children in with orthopedic injuries, and they were told, their parents were told to give them Tylenol or Motrin, depending on their age, when they went home. I never understood that. Had several conversations with ER doctors about why that, and their response usually is, "Well, we're just afraid the parents are going to overdose them trying to look out for their children in pain," which still really didn't make a whole lot of sense, because in the literature, parents usually are less likely to give that pain medication than an adult would give themselves. And then I had a former student that actually worked in the high-risk nursery, and this was very appalling to me. I just could not believe it. She had said that at that particular facility where she worked in the high-risk nursery, that the preemie babies would go to surgery and they were given paralytics and nothing else. And I just couldn't believe it. I had had a my own experience of having a minor procedure done, and my IV came apart, and so I didn't get on my medication, and I was actually awake but couldn't move when they were about to start the procedure. And had it not been for my surgeon paying attention to me, I probably would have been awake the entire time. And it was a very traumatic experience for me. And I can only imagine what it would be like. And we're talking intestinal surgeries or, you know, what major surgeries for these babies. And so all of this just kept playing in my mind, thinking, why would nurses do that? I also, when I was doing OB clinicals at another facility, when they started using Imlicream for circumcisions, and you know, you have to have that on for a certain period of time for it to be effective, and the longer it's on, the more effective that it is. And I would hear the nurses say, oh, so-and-so just got off the elevator to do circ on whatever baby it was, and they would say, oh my gosh, I haven't put the Imlicream on yet. And they wouldn't tell him that the baby had not had any anesthesia. So you just kind of wonder, and I'm very analytical, so I'm like, I just don't understand that, because I would not want that happening. So all of that brought about my problem, or my dissertation project. And we all know that in the literature, pain management continues to be a problem in healthcare, regardless of how old you are, and that there are negative effects from prolonged pain experiences if their pain is not assessed properly and then managed properly. And that specifically, there are some vulnerable populations that are underrepresented in, at least the time of my dissertation, samples in pain research. And those were preverbal children. Just a little comical side note, when I graduated with my PhD, they announced the title of your dissertation. And my dissertation was a grounded theory study of pain management behaviors of nurses who care for preverbal children. And at two different events that day, they announced my dissertation as a grounded study of pain management behaviors of nurses who care for proverbial children. And I just, nothing to do with this presentation, but I just thought it was kind of funny, because a lot of people say, ooh, preverbal? Less than 3 years old is how I defined them in my study. My research question was, what are the processes nurses engage in when managing pain in preverbal children? If they can't rank pain on a scale of 1 to 10, or they can't actually identify the face for Wong's faces assessment tool, then how actually do those nurses decide that that baby or that child is in pain, and then what do they do about it? My specific aim was to use the grounded theory method due to a lot of conflicting data that was out there in the literature as far as the knowledge and attitudes of nurses for pain management in the pediatric population. My participants, I did qualitative research, and I'm not sure if y'all are all familiar, but sometimes people say you only had 11 participants. I did. I interviewed until I saturated my data. I had 10 Caucasian participants and one African American. 9 were females, 2 males, just trying to cover the gambit of gender and ethnicity and to see if that might have impacted their responses. 27% of them were single and 73% were married, and 6 were parents and 5 had no children. Wanted to make sure that being a parent or being a mother specifically did not impact their decision making when it came to pain management. The number of years of pediatric experience ranged from 1 to 30 years, with a mean of 14.01 years. So I wanted to make sure that the novice to the very experienced nurse to see if they had varied responses. 7 of the participants worked in a moderate-sized inpatient pediatric unit and or pediatric intensive care unit. 2 participants worked in a small inpatient pediatric unit in a small acute care hospital, and 2 were employed at a large pediatric hospital that was actually a magnet facility. Of course, I got approval through our Human Assurance Committee at Medical College of Georgia, which is where I received my degree. And each participant signed their informed consent, and of course confidentiality was maintained. This is my theoretical definition of pain. There are several out there, and one of the ones that we generally use is, pain is whatever the person says that it is. Well, if you can't talk, than really what is pain. So for that just to be a good old standby and what you always go back to, and there are even adults that can't, you know, comatose patients or mentally handicapped patients that really cannot verbalize their pain experience. So really looked beyond what we usually accept as a good definition for pain. I did semi-structured interviews lasting about an hour, and they were all videotaped, and I actually personally transcribed them word for word. These were the questions that were asked of all of my participants. Of course, when you do qualitative, if you get a response, then you can also ask additional questions, which also impacts, you know, the further interviews that you did. And I won't bore you with reading those questions. Data analysis, I did line-by-line coding. Anybody ever done qualitative research? Strauss says, you know, you can feel like you're drowning. And honestly, there was a point in time early on that I just felt like I was drowning, although I really felt like a good job of not doing my next interview until I had analyzed that first one. And I think that's where a lot of people make a, you know, they just want to hurry up and get all of their interviews done so they can get on with it. And then you've got all this data that you're having to deal with. I did the constant comparative analysis, which is pretty common with grounded theory. And axial coding, or coding along dimensions, so what were the themes, the dimensions that each of the responses that they had. And then as I analyzed an interview, it allowed me to really choose my next participant. Like say, for instance, my first participant mentioned that she felt like she was a mother, and she felt like that had something to do with her pain management decision making. So my next participant, I actually found someone with very similar nursing experience, but that was not a mother, which that's very difficult because she had like 23, 24 years of nursing experience. This was actually my model that I built out, and there was a lot of stuff that I found out. A lot of intrinsic kind of things that happen. There is this process that goes on in the middle of all of this. There were certain things like playing the game with the physicians. There's literature back to the early 1960s that actually was written by a physician talking about playing the game with the nurses and how you have to kind of make it seem as if it's their idea or whatever the case may be, which I thought was interesting. Culture of the hospital, knowing the territory, how well you are oriented to that particular area, personal attributes of the RN, and then the workload also affected all of that environment as well. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that because I really want to get to the meat of what piece that Amy used in her project. And that was actually the recognition from my participants. And then it was validated in the literature that there was a lack of appropriate pain assessment tools for children less than 3 years of age. I was currently working in a trauma center, and so I was very aware and used the assessment tools that we had for all of our patients. And anytime the infants came in, or 1, 2, 3 year olds came in, we always used the Wong's faces. And in my research, found out that the Wong's is only a valid tool down to 36 months. So any child less than 36 years of age, it was not an appropriate tool for them to use. But you've got a whole facility that is actually bought into, well, it's a pediatric pain assessment, and you know, your 1 to 3 year olds are their pediatric patients. So what do we need to do about that? And I guess there wasn't a whole lot of research into what was appropriate. Some of them didn't even use the tool, even though they had Wong's faces and it might have been somewhat of a an assessment tool. A lot of them didn't even use that. They just really relied on the parent to tell them, and then they just gave medication, whatever the parent said that the child was experiencing, or they had their own way of assessing pain. And the literature will tell you that If you don't have a valid and reliable tool for assessing pain, then your pain management decisions and interventions are probably not as appropriate as they could be. So these were my references for that. And with that, Amy started into DNP school and also influenced by culture. She's a pediatric person herself and was interested in pain management. And so she kind of took that information and built her project around that. Is this your slide? And I'm going to turn it over to Amy. Sorry, you have to.
Okay, I'm Amy Vail, and I think I have to hold this. I don't have anything to hold my microphone. And so I was working with Sherry at the time, and I did, I called her on the phone when I got accepted into the program, and I was familiar with her PhD program because it was the same school I was going to, Medical College of Georgia, and I was interested in what she had researched, and so I asked her if there was anything that she found, you know, doing her dissertation that she would like put into practice. So she came up with a couple of things, and one of those was the pain assessment tool. So the first bullet there is the same I used, it was what Sherry used in her dissertation, what pain was defined as. And then JACO mandated pain assessment and documentation in all of their institutions and hospitals. And also the American Pain Society coined pain as the fifth vital sign. So they wanted the nurses to assess for pain as often as vital signs were being assessed, which it was not happening at the institution I chose as well. And also, like Sherry said, the Wong Faces scale, that was being used in the hospitals. And the hospital I chose to do my project in, that was the only pain scale they used, was the Wong Faces scale. And then for adults, of course, they asked them the number. So my problem statement were nurses are currently using an inappropriate scale to determine pain in preverbal children, and that the Wong scale is only indicated for use in children greater than 3 years of age. So I based most of my project on what Noviello found, Sherry found in her study, and that the nurses on the small and mid-sized pediatrics unit in Georgia think that the use of a pain assessment tool is not valuable and the tool being used is inappropriate for preverbal children. And my project was in the mid-sized hospital that she used some of her subjects from. And preverbal children are at risk for inconsistent pain identification and inadequate pain relief. So in the literature, there were consequences of prolonged pain in neonates in preverbal children. And that was, they had increased O2 consumption, O2 deficiency to vital tissues, impaired immune functions, alterations in clotting time, and potential end organ dysfunctions if their pain was not treated. So also, the literature out there states that neonates experienced pain just as adults. They had nerve endings in the skin just as adults did. But we had to look at behavior changes in the physiological responses because they could not verbalize what they were going through. So my purpose of my DNP project was to improve nursing practice regarding pain assessment in preverbal children. By doing this, I wanted to educate the pediatric staff nurses the necessity of assessing for pain in preverbal children and to promote the use of the FLAC scale when assessing for pain, and I'll show you this scale. I chose the FLAC scale because it was designed to measure pain in preverbal children. Also, some of the later studies showed that this scale can be used in unconscious adults. Anytime that you cannot communicate, you can look at this scale. And this is the scale here. Also, I chose it because it was a 0 to 10 scale, just like the FACES scale they were using. So there were 5 categories. In each category, you could score 0 to 2. So in the chart documentation, you could still use a 0 to 10 or 1 to 10 scale that they were using. So by doing this, this is her literature review. I'm not going to go through that again. So the hospital I used was a 400-bed acute care facility in Georgia. The pediatrics unit that I was going to implement my project on consisted of 28 beds. There was a small PICU unit in that, on that floor as well. I went and talked to the nurse manager, and the nurse manager proposed a census of 50 preverbal children per month. This was during the winter months and the spring months where the census was a little bit higher than in the summertime. So it was a good time to do the study. There were 38 nurses currently employed on that unit, and I chose to use RNs and LPNs just because those were the ones that could give out pain medication, so that would be who would be assessing for pain. So my plan was to do conduct educational in-services with the nurses, the staff nurses. I was going to do chart reviews, pre and post implementation of the FLAC scale on the floor, and surveys. I was going to survey the nurses, and I surveyed before I implemented the FLAC scale and surveyed after. Also, Sherry was a sub-investigator, and then I had another member of the, she was a staff nurse, a staff RN, and she was part of the clinical advancement program. It was a program that the hospital was using to implement evidence-based nursing and any type of program to show and improve patient outcomes. And she was currently on that floor and very active, so she agreed to be a sub-investigator as well, which turned out that she was an advocate of this project, and I think helped get a response rate that we were looking for. So my in-services, I actually did four in-services, AM and PM. They were 12-hour shifts. I chose different days, and I tried to get as many of the nurses as I could. I had recruitment posters and flyers sent out, and she also went around and told everybody and reminded them to come to the in-services. So during the in-service, I made little laminated copies of the FLAC scale, also in all the charts. I put the FLAC scale in the top of the chart because it was paper charts. And then in each patient room on the bulletin board, there was a FLAC scale as well. So that scale was everywhere. I gave them the scale. I demonstrated on a child how to properly use the FLAC scale. And then at the end of the in-service, I distributed the surveys. She actually, the sub-investigator, went around and tried to help remind them to complete the surveys. And they sent it back in through the mail, the U.S. mail, so they came back to me. So the surveys were pre and post FLAC implementation. I did ask like general questions, age, gender, level of education, years of experience, and I kind of trailed off of Sherry's and wanted to know the years of nursing experience. Do you have children? And the three big questions were, what percentage of time did you use a pain scale? Was it easy to use? And what were the barriers to use? In the chart reviews, we kind of just made something. We were looking for age of the child. If there was a specific diagnosis, I didn't know if we would come back later and kind of look at another study to see if there was more pain assessment with whatever diagnosis, what scale was used, and if pain medication was given. And so Sherry and I did that. I think we actually ended up looking at 487 charts for the 3 months that it was implemented. This is just the survey demographics. My survey was not matched. So there was a group that turned it in before and a group that turned it in after. So that was kind of a weakness of the study. But there was very little difference in the pre and post survey. This, I did ask them what pain assessment tool they used. Pre-FLAC, just about all of them used the Wong Faces scale. And you can see after I implemented, it dramatically switched over to using the FLAC scale. There was 22 that filled out the first and 20 that filled out the second, so it was close. In the survey, there were two significance. One was which tool you used, and that's, I showed you that on the pie graph, and the other is, do you use a pain assessment tool? And so that changed as well. In the chart review, I'm sorry, that's wrong. So I asked about workload, time, and too hard to understand. The one that was significant over here was the pain assessment scale too hard to understand. Post-survey using the FLAC scale, there were zero responses to that. For some reason, the Wong, they had a hard time understanding that. Chart review results, there was a significant increase in the time pain was assessed each day from 1.28 to 4.48 times a day, which still isn't as much as you should be doing vital signs, but it still increased dramatically. So the key findings were the use of the pain scale increased, The tool was switched over from the Wong scale to the Flack scale. 85% were using a Flack scale. And then the documentation went up. On the chart review, when Sherry and I did the chart review, we went through the charts, and on one side of it, there was a place where you could document pain assessment, a number. We also looked in the back under the nurse's notes, and we saw that they were writing no distress noted, no complaints. We didn't know if that meant no pain, so we didn't include that as assessing for pain. So in the future, and that was something that I talked to the nurse manager about, you know, making sure that they did document pain. On the survey at the bottom, there were a couple of responses that the manager did not value pain assessment, and the agency did not value pain assessment, and that there was a lack of a place to document in the chart, which there was. There was just where you put the number, that's it. Implications for practice. There was an increased awareness of pain management in preverbal children. Most of the nurses, when I went into the in-services, did not know that they were not supposed to use the Wong FACES scale. That was just the scale that was used in the hospital, so they did not know that they should have looked further into it. The in-services provided positive results. This information can be used to implement the Flack scale at other. My intent was for it to be used in the ER, the OR, and any other place in that hospital besides the PEDS floor to go further with it. In future studies, I would like to see it, you know, used in a variety of locations. I think one of the hospitals that Sherry, the larger hospital, or the children's hospital, they did use the Flack scale. This was not a specific children's hospital. So, we also wanted to look at physician prescribing practices. We didn't know if you prescribed pain medicine on the chart, if they would assess for pain more often, and also the attitudes of management. Since there was a documentation that management was not a priority for them. The limitations of this, it was a small sample size. The nurses, they were not matched. However, the charts, we had a lot of charts we went through. The type of hospital, like I said, it was not a children's hospital. Children's hospitals, sometimes they do focus more on pain, and they have different in-services for that. This was a large teaching hospital. Surveys were not matched. The Flack documentation was limited. What we looked at in the chart review was to see if they documented also what they used to assess. When I went through the in-service, I asked them to put down what pain scale they used. In post, we could see Flack was used a lot, but pre, you didn't know what they used. That was just the survey that was telling us that. The survey tool and the chart review tool, we made that. So it was kind of a pilot tool. Jaco visited the institution during this my project, and this institution received a RFI recommendation for pain assessment documentation. So this project was used with the task force, with that sub-investigator from the hospital, to show Jaco that they had improvements in documentation. The director stated that she was going to continue to use this scale on the floor and provide it to the other areas in the hospital as well. And that's it. Do you have any questions for either of us? They're recording.
Okay. It's for recording purposes.
I was going to say I project very well. Did you find a difference in the provider and the pain management? Let me explain further. Did you find a difference in advanced practice nurses' use of pain control items versus physician use of pain control items?
No, because we did not have advanced practice nurses coming into the hospital at that time.
Okay.
We do now, but it's still not on the pediatrics floor.
Because I find, in our practice, that as advanced practice providers, we're very generous, whereas some of our physician colleagues are not.
Right.
So I thought this was very interesting.
The pediatrician I work with is also a best friend of mine, and when I told her about the project, because she's on the board at the hospital, she had no idea, and this was maybe a year ago, that I even did this project. She has not you know, she did not know that there was a problem. So the PD, they didn't know anything was going on, and they should. And that was the part about physicians' attitudes towards prescribing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked her if you thought that if you included that in orders, admission orders, that they would kind of assess for pain more often. So that is more, you know, something to look into.
And as we were doing the chart review, we found that there were certain diagnoses that you would make assumptions would have a lot of pain related to them that was in the literature, but the physicians were not ordering anything for pain except for maybe Tylenol or ibuprofen. And so we just thought that that really did need to be addressed.
Right.
You might have said this, but did you look at whether assessment of pain related at all to administration of pain medication?
We did document if pain medication was given, and there was nothing significant found as far as results. But I can tell you anecdotally, us looking at it, they would have given pain medication and they would not come and reassess. There was still not pain assessment done.
Even using the NuScan.
Right, right. Anybody else?
Hello. I just wanted to say your study was great. I found it very interesting. I'm a nurse anesthetist, and probably 80% of my patient population are children. I work at a large teaching facility that is a children's hospital within a large facility. And I find in my practice that my colleagues under-medicate children under 3 on a daily basis, and the surgeons is a constant battle with them to write for pain control postoperatively. Many times our services consulted to help with that. But so I think it's not, I mean, I'm in the business of pain control, and my colleagues are not doing a good job in children under 3. So the bedside nurse is very important, because that's the key to the physician in the post-op period for us, or in the pre-op period before surgery. So I think it's a great study, and bedside nurses really need to be aware that kids under 3 need that accurate assessment and follow-up.
The thing I'd like to add to that is that in my study, found that the attitudes of newer, younger nurses or less experienced nurses, they were less likely to call physicians for like more orders or whatever. And those individuals, those new nurses, tend to be put on nights when they are waking physicians up and they are getting treated not so professionally on the phone, which further causes them not to want to call physicians. And so the children end up, you know, hurting all night long because of that. So it's certainly, it's a multifaceted problem.
It's even more important to have these PRN orders with NSAIDs and Tylenol and PRN narcotic orders written on the charts so that the nurses can use their assessment, bedside assessment skills, without calling the, and we're spoiled a little bit because we have residents, so they don't feel as guilty for calling the residents in the night.
Right.
Typically, you know, but I just.
And see, the pediatrician I work with, she actually teaches the residents. So she is actually trying to make it a priority for the residents to learn that this needs to be done and to follow up with the nurses. Did you assess for pain before, and did you come back and reassess for pain?
You know, not just, you know, like just looking at them to see, it's not just about medicating them. It's about, you know, is there compartment syndrome going on or something else besides that? So.
I found both of your studies fascinating. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner from South Carolina, if you can't tell from my accent. And one of the things that I think I'm guilty of is under-medicating sometimes, to be honest. We have a very significant problem on the East Coast because of prescription painkillers, and we have found that a lot of times parents will use their children on the outpatient setting to gain pain medications, and so I think that there's a huge concern there. But my question for you is this. It is unethical to allow anyone to be in pain when we know that they are. Are there any studies being conducted on the ethics related to not addressing pain, and what's happening to these physician colleagues, and I guess our advanced practice nurses who are just choosing to not address pain? Because I think that's happening a lot. I mean, if I really truly believe that a person's in pain, I'm not going to allow that to happen. But I think I do try to err more along the lines of the NSAIDs and the Tylenols before I will jump to a narcotic, probably. Maybe I should do a narcotic sooner than I probably do. Won't allow them to be in pain. I'm not trying to say that, but I do see some that will not, absolutely, never do it. Are there any studies out there? Are we looking at that? And if they are doing that, what are the consequences?
And I'm just going to respond to that from the literature that I looked at for my study. And and I can't remember the percentage off the top of my head, so please forgive me, but I want to say that it was around 15% of the nurses that did not even believe that preverbal children experienced pain. And if you can imagine that still exists today with all the research that's going on. So I don't think that we have specifically addressed that in nursing education at the undergraduate level, and I'm not so sure that those things are really addressed in medical school either. Pediatrics is one of those specialty areas, and I don't think as much time is spent as opposed to your general med surg adult, older adult kind of experiences. And a lot of the literature also hinted to the concern of addiction and things like that. I don't recall anything specific. You made a really good point about the parent actually using the narcotics that were prescribed for their children, but that the addiction for the child is a concern as well, just like it is for any population as well. I have not looked at the literature lately, but I don't think that there are a lot of studies out there about the ethics.
Well, I do know I'm the parent of six children, the single parent of six, and they range between 26 and 3. And I'm hearing a lot of stories, and I was an elementary school teacher beforehand, and I'm hearing a lot of stories even now in elementary school. I know this is inpatient, but even with the outpatient for the ADHD drugs, where they're selling them, mm-hmm. and they're going in mom and dad's cabinets even for pain medicines mm-hmm. and selling them. So for me, I guess in the back of my mind as a provider, it's not always about not wanting to address it as much as is a concern about the addiction, because we have, the other day we had an 8-year-old who came in asking for some Addies, yeah. Adderall. And so, you just kind of are getting concerned. So I was a little concerned about what was out there as far as the literature. So
I did not see anything specifically. Now, I know in practice that is the reality of what's going on. Even working at an pediatric after hours, there were some physicians who said, do not give any narcotic cough syrup or anything. They did not want us to prescribe that. And the physician I work for, she does let me, but we do 2 ounces, so a small amount, and then reassess. If they still have pain, they need to come in. Of course, she takes care of them in the hospital, but if this is outpatient coming in with an injury or something, we do a small amount, and if they need more, they come in and we need to reassess. But teaching in the nurse practitioner program, I teach pediatrics, and I do teach this scale, but I do think they learn by who they're with, and they see by who they're with. I have students with me, and they see the moms that come in, and that we already know that's where the Adderall's going, or they'll come in and complain that their child has a cough, and it's over and over and over again, and you know they don't want to use inhalers or preventatives, so you kind of pick out and know what's going on with that. Well, thank you so much for coming.
We enjoyed your interactions. And you're out 20 minutes early.